me and then you.
Here we go.
Me and then you. From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The Enron Corporation could not have become a global giant, trampling human rights and the environment all along the way, without an incredible degree of support from the U.S. government. Only when Enron's leadership revealed their greed on American home turf did that become the biggest corporate scandal in recent U.S. history.
Enron's pawns, how public institutions bankrolled Enron's globalization game. Then, before this Sunday's Oscars, we'll take a look at John Q, the Hollywood movie that takes on the insurance industry.
Blood pressure is dropping fast. He's going into cardiac arrest.
I don't understand.
Mike's heart is useless. He's going to need a transplant or he's going to die.
What will make Mike so sick?
Transplant surgery is very expensive.
We got insurance.
There are no provisions in your policy for a procedure of this magnitude.
The sad fact, that kind of situation happens every day in America.
We'll talk with two legal health experts about the insurance industry. And the Oscar-nominated documentary Promises, Israel and Palestine Through the Eyes of Children. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. News reports out of Pakistan say U.S. Special Forces are continuing their efforts to locate 18 American soldiers taken hostage by Taliban and Al-Qaeda fighters during the most intense fighting in the snow-covered peaks of the Arma region of eastern Afghanistan. The reports also say high-level negotiations are going on between the Americans and the Taliban, who now are demanding the safe release of more than 350 prisoners being held at Camp X-Ray in Guantanamo, Cuba. These reports come after the Frontier Post reported 18 U.S. soldiers were taken hostage during the severe fighting known as Operation Anaconda. According to newly released documents, Iraq has asked the United Nations whether U.S. actions toward Saddam Hussein violate international law. Secretary General Kofi Annan passed this and 18 other questions posed by Iraq to the UN Security Council, asking for any response it might want to provide by April 10th. The questions were given to Annan by the Iraqi foreign minister during talks earlier this month, focusing on the return of weapons inspectors. A second round of UN-Iraq talks is expected to be held April 18th. The Bush administration continues its threats to escalate its attacks against Iraq. Already, the country is regularly bombed by U.S. and British forces in northern and southern Iraq, according to UN reports. Iraq's infant and child population has been especially hard hit, with some 2,690 to more than 5,300 dying each month from waterborne and malnutrition-related diseases. The Bush administration yesterday proposed changing some of federal rules designed to protect the confidentiality of Americans' medical records. The proposal would alter a federal safeguard that compels patients to give written permission before their records may be disclosed to doctors, hospitals, pharmacies, and insurance companies. Would also enable more parents to find out what medical services their teenagers seek and give business associates of various health care providers more time before they have to follow confidentiality rules. And in more news that's raised privacy concerns, the National Park Service has announced it'll begin round-the-clock video surveillance of all major monuments. The move was prompted by last year's so-called terrorist attacks on two national symbols, the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. Among the monuments that will receive closed-circuit television cameras are the Jefferson, Lincoln, Franklin, Delano Roosevelt, Vietnam Veterans, and Korean War Memorials. The cameras are expected to be installed by October. The Park Service says this is the first time it's used video surveillance to monitor public areas in and around the Washington Monument. The intentions of the Parks Service were disclosed in testimony submitted for delivery to a congressional panel today, which has drawn sharp questioning from Congress members like Maryland Republican Constance Morella, chair of the House Government Reform Subcommittee, which called a hearing on expanding use of electronic surveillance in the nation's capital. She asked, how long are they going to capture on these cameras every face of every person who is there? How long do they hold this material? Who will have access to it? And today there will be a protest outside the Federal Communications Commission in Washington, D.C. We turn now to Sita Pena Gangadharan, who is with Media Channel. Why are people gathering outside the FCC on this freezing cold day on the East Coast?
We're outside the FCC this afternoon at 3 p.m. in Washington, D.C. because we're angry. We're absolutely disgusted with how the media has been corporatized and how media regulation has played out in favor of corporate lobbyists. We're angry with Michael Powell, who has made a mockery of the public interest, who has said in speeches that he has no idea what the public interest means, and we're sick of corporate media that doesn't represent our lives and our communities and our diversity. So an ad hoc committee of media activists around the country have banded together, and we're descending down on the FCC to give some divining knowledge to Michael Powell and the rest of the FCC cohorts. We're dressed as angels of the public interest, and we'll present a crystal ball to Michael Powell, embarrassing him for his disavowal of the public interest. And we have a wonderful lineup of speakers: Jeff Chester from the Center for Digital Democracy, Terry O'Neill from Now, Dee Dee Halleck, founder of Deep Dish TV, Peter Hart from FAIR, an archangel of the public interest, and the billionaires for more media mergers.
Sita Pena Gangadharan with Media Channel. And you are listening to Democracy Now! As we go live in our Firehouse studio.
To the Pope.
To Denny Bonet.
And the Dalai Lama. Mother Teresa and Madam Pajama. And according to the Bible, King James Edition, bigger is always better. Bigger is always better. Bigger is always better. Well, you may be thinking while you're sitting there drinking that some things are better left small. But when you put a lot of small things together, you get something bigger, and that's better. Now, why tell a white lie when you could tell a whopper? Why be a bad guy when you can be a copper? Why be copper when you can be gold? Why be gold when you can be platinum? Why be platinum when you can be a diamond? Why be an island when you could be a continent? Why be incontinent when you can be a planet? Damn it. Can I say damn it? Damn it. Bigger, yeah, is always better. Bigger is always better. Bigger, bigger is always better. Bigger is always better. Break it down. The bigger it is, the better it is. The taller it is, the better it is. The wider it is, the better it is. The fatter it is, the better it is. The longer it is, the better it is. The harder it is, the better it is. The louder it is, the better it is. The bigger it is, the better it is. Bigger is always better.
Bigger is always better. Denny Bonet and guitarist Tony Salvatore live in our Firehouse studio. and it could be the motto of the subject of our next topic, and that is Enron, here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. The Institute for Policy Studies is releasing an explosive report today saying Enron Corporation was able to become a global giant only because of government agencies, both U.S. and foreign, giving it more than $7 billion in publicly funded financing over the past decade. Just going to read from the introduction, saying that since 1992, at least 20 agencies representing the U.S. government, multilateral development banks, and other national governments helped leverage Enron's global reach. The now fallen giant, until recently the country's seventh largest corporation, marched into risky projects abroad backed by the deep pockets of government financing. Then I'm going to talk about some of the examples that they use, saying Enron's overseas operations rewarded shareholders temporarily, but often punished the people and governments of foreign countries with price hikes and blackouts worse than what happened in California in 2001, causing social unrest, riots that were sometimes brutally repressed. For example, in the Dominican Republic, eight people were killed when police were brought in to quell riots after blackouts lasting up to 20 hours followed an Enron-initiated power price hike. In India, police hired by the power consortium, of which Enron was a part, beat nonviolent protesters who challenged the $30 billion agreement, the largest deal in Indian history, struck between local politicians and Enron. The president of Guatemala tried to dissolve the Congress and declare martial law after rioting followed an Enron-maneuvered price hike. In Panama, the man who negotiated the asking price for Enron's stake in power production was the brother-in-law of the head of the country's state-owned power company. Rioting followed suspicions of corruption in Enron's price hikes and power outages there, too. In Colombia, two politicians resigned amid accusations that one was trying to push a cut-rate deal for Enron and the state-owned power company. While all this is occurring, the U.S. government and other public agencies continue to advocate on Enron's behalf, threatening poor countries like Mozambique with an end to aid if they did not accept Enron's bid on a natural gas field. Well, let's let our guests tell the rest of this story. Jim Vallette and Daphne Wisham are with the Institute for Policy Studies, and they co-authored this report. Jim Vallette, let's begin with you first. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks very much. An honor to be here.
And can you just start off by laying out how public institutions bankrolled Enron's globalization game?
Well, it really has its origins back in the Reagan administration. One of his first initiatives on the global level in 1981 was to kind of steer World Bank financing in the energy sector away from public financing towards publicly owned projects, and steering it into private business, particularly U.S. business. That Reagan doctrine of privatization of international finance of energy really hit its stride in the early 1990s. Not just the World Bank pushed this privatization process, but other regional development banks like the Inter-American Development Bank, Asian Development Bank, they really opened the doors to developing countries' energy sectors, power plants, pipelines, transmission lines. And Enron was very often first in line.
Daphne Wisham, your key findings when it comes to the World Bank.
I'm sorry. I was just going to jump in with a little additional point on Jim's raising the issue of the Reagan policies. What is critical to understand is that all of this happened after the OPEC oil crisis of the 1970s. And basically what was going on in the minds of the officials in the Reagan administration was they were concerned that they wanted to get more non-OPEC sources of oil on the market so that they wouldn't be held hostage by the OPEC countries as they raised their prices for oil. So they turned to the World Bank as an intermediary of sorts to basically get the World Bank to play the role that they couldn't play, because they would be literally, and this is actually in the documents that we found, that they would be suspect, the U.S. government officials would be suspect, because they are
they are perceived as advocating for the oil companies. So instead, they had the World Bank push the agenda, namely to diversify non-OPEC sources of oil and to privatize, as Jim said, and open up these markets for private investors so that the U.S. could acquire more cheap sources of oil from global markets. Now, this is a critical point because the World Bank has been claiming for quite some time now that their energy investments are all about poverty alleviation and sustainable development in places like Chad and Cameroon and Nigeria and elsewhere. And, of course, we know that that's not the case. We know that, in fact, on the ground, the poorest are the ones most hardest hit by oil and gas exploration. They pay the highest price in terms of environmental destruction and in terms of human rights abuses. But what's really fascinating to me as somebody who's been looking into these issues for quite some time is to now see it in writing that this agenda was actually articulated very clearly in 1981 as a U.S. agenda and that the World Bank is essentially acting on behalf of the U.S. and therefore the Enron debacle is part and parcel of that same agenda.
Jim Vallette, you have a very interesting timetable, the Enron's Pawns timetable. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if you can go through it, the development of Enron from the time of Ronald Reagan imposing the policies prescriptions as condition of support for the World Bank, which include privatization, the kind of things Daphne was just talking about, and then moving on from there.
Sure. Well, about 4 years later, Enron was formed from a merger between Houston Natural Gas and Internorth. '86, Ken Lay became CEO of Enron. And then in '88, we started to really see kind of the patterns that came to light beginning in December to the general public. Those patterns became obvious way back in 1988. A couple of Enron executives were accused of...
This is when George Bush is elected.
That's right. Two executives were accused of diverting $142 million in company funds to Panamanian and other offshore accounts between '85 and '87. They were tried in Manhattan civil courts. And back then, Ken Lay, like today, claimed ignorance of activities related to this fraud. Also in 1988, George W. Bush, he was then working on his dad's campaign, took time out to call Argentina's Minister of Public Works. And this was reported in The Nation in 94. He called Rodolfo Taragno and allegedly to pressure him to accept Enron's what Taragno called a laughable bid to build a gas pipeline in Argentina. And so that began a whole string of calls and pressure tactics by U.S. government officials and politicians on developing countries to accept Enron into their infrastructure.
While he called it a laughable bid, Carlos Menem, the president, then accepts this bid.
Right.
Do you think that Argentina today is connected to Enron then, the troubles that Argentina is facing?
Well, there's been a tremendous amount of international financing for the opening up, the privatization of Argentina's energy sector. Billions of dollars of U.S. and World Bank monies have poured into Argentina to open up pipelines for Enron as well as plenty of other companies. There's a whole network of pipelines that have sprung up throughout South America with Enron behind them. And I don't know, Daphne, you have something on Argentina?
Well, I actually wanted to just jump in with a couple of stories that I think are really important that aren't being told in the mainstream media coverage that we've gotten so far. And one of them is a really, I think, an explosive story having to do with the situation in the Dominican Republic. Basically, what happened there is that after the Dominican Republic, it's the same pattern of, you know, privatization and deregulation as the sort of entree for Enron to come into the country, and then you know the World Bank helps Enron develop power projects and so on. What was explosive in my mind is that a local Arthur Anderson affiliate actually assessed the local utility at almost $1 billion less than its actual value. And then Enron and a couple of other companies came in, AES and Union Fenosa of Spain. They all rushed in to buy this vastly underpriced utility, almost $1 billion under its value, thanks to Arthur Anderson in the Dominican Republic. So they reaped, enormous fortunes off of this fire sale of this utility. And then they pulled a California. In other words, they claimed that there was a power shortage. They jacked up the rates immediately. There were blackouts that lasted for 20 hours. Hospitals, schools, businesses were all affected. And, of course, the people were outraged. They were outraged because of this incredible profiteering at the hands of these corporations. They took to the streets. They demonstrated. The police violently reacted to the demonstrations, killing 8 people, including a 14-year-old boy. This story has not been told, and there are other stories in our report. Jim, did you want to mention the Colombia story that I think is also quite explosive?
We're talking to Daphne Weisham and Jim Vallette. They are co-authors of this extremely important report that's being released today, Enron's Pawns, How Public Institutions Bankrolled Enron's Globalization Game.
Well, everywhere we looked, it was amazing as we looked for public financing of Enron around the world. First, we were amazed by how deep the pockets were of government institutions financing Enron's global reach. But also, when that financing occurred or was approved, it was amazing what the net impacts were on the people in developing countries. And it was just a litany of tales of corruption, shady deals, environmental problems. Daphne mentioned Colombia, and the Multilateral Investment Guarantee Agency, an arm of the World Bank, in Panama, they financed last year a stake in a power plant developed by Enron there, Bahia Las Minas. The institution that they financed to invest in the Enron power plant, their name came up in a Senate investigation into money laundering last year, the same year, actually before the MIGA guarantee was issued. And their name came up tied to a Colombian bank that has been since been closed, that was tied to narco money laundering. MIGA shows how eager international financial institutions are to finance fossil fuel power plants, Enron's power plants around the world, without looking at who exactly they're backing.
And
in addition to that, one other piece that involves George Bush in the Colombia case is that in October 1999, when George Bush was governor of Texas, he met with Colombian President Andres Pastrana, as well as executives from Enron and other oil companies. And it was at that meeting that Pastrana tried to rally support for Plan Colombia and promised major oil and gas exploration concessions and a continuation of the privatization agenda that the World Bank and others were eager to see them pursue. And then 2 months after this meeting in Texas, two of the officials who were there and participating in the meeting with George Bush and Pastrana ended up in a fight that became quite public when one accused the other of trying to push this sweetheart deal for Enron that would, you know, once again be basically selling off Colombia's assets at way below their market value so that Enron could get a share in the natural gas production for this power plant that Jim mentioned that was going online in Panama and channeling the money for this through this bank that was accused of laundering drug money. So there's just, you know, I mean, it's a very complicated story, and that's why it took us 55 pages to write it all out.
Well, finally, you talk about the connections today to Cheney, the meetings he had with Ken Lay. Why are they so significant? I mean, you have, for the first time ever, the Office of Management and Budget is suing the White House for information, or government agency is suing the White House for information about his meetings with energy officials in developing his energy policy. But I think at the root of that, probably of the cover-up, is the extensive meetings that Cheney has had with Ken Lay. Why is this so important?
Jim, do you want to?
Well, it's really, it could expose the depth of government collaboration with the likes of Enron in the development of energy policy, and how that interacts also with geopolitics. I mean, you look at the Caspian region, both when Cheney was the CEO of Halliburton, he had quite a bit of dealings in the Caspian region. And then he took that business portfolio into the old executive office building and developed an energy strategy as vice president that advances the business interests of the likes of Halliburton and Enron. And so, in the Caspian region today, we have seen a lot of trade and development agency financing for Enron studies of potential pipelines in the region. You have OPEC and Exim poised to pour hundreds of millions of dollars into a oil pipeline from the Caspian region out to European markets in Turkey. So there's this confluence.
You're suggesting the war could have something to do with this, the bombing of Afghanistan.
I don't know about that, but if you look at if you map out Enron's projects around the world, you see some real strings of investments in South America. They've had the most advanced development of pipeline systems and power plants. It looks like they were trying to develop a very similar interconnected system of pipelines reaching from China to the Balkans.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us. The end of that introduction: only when Enron scandals began to affect Americans did these same government officials and institutions hold the corporation at arm's length. And only when Enron leadership revealed their greed on home turf did it become the biggest corporate scandal in recent U.S. history. Thank you for exposing their involvement around the world. Enron's Pawns: How Public Institutions Bankrolled Enron's Globalization Game. The report is out today from the Institute for Policy Studies, IPS.org, by Jim Vallette and Daphne Wysham. You're listening to Democracy Now!
Do you think it'll rain? Blue is your color, don't make them like they used to. War is a bummer, don't you love the commercials? They're having a sale. What's your hobby? It's as big as a whale. Can you tell me the time? Come here often, life's a bitch. Ever swim with a dolphin? There's a new one from Spielberg. The dog don't bite. Keep it simple, keep it light. We're going around with what we say. We're moving our mouth up and down all day. Talking loud, talking small.
And you're listening to our live musicians in the studios here at Democracy Now!, Denny Bonet and Tony Salvatore. You are listening to Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. The Oscars are this Sunday. In 74 years of the Oscars, the most prestigious movie awards, only 6 acting trophies have gone to African Americans. This year, however, the honorary Oscar will go to Sidney Poitier for his life's work. 38 years ago, he won Best Actor for Lilies of the Field. This year is the first time African-American actors could win both major acting categories. Halle Berry is up for Best Actress in Monsters Ball and Denzel Washington for Training Day. Today, we're going to take a look at another Denzel Washington film, one that was released too late to be nominated for the Oscars this year. John Q was released 5 weeks ago. This week, it's the number 8 top-grossing movie in U.S. theaters. John Q may be unique among Hollywood films in its explicit intention to affect people's opinions on health policy issues. Denzel Washington plays a father whose son is denied access to a heart transplant because his insurance policy doesn't cover the $250,000 operation. The hospital refuses to put the boy's name on the heart recipient list unless his parents pay $75,000 upfront. So Washington's character takes the matter in his own hands. Even before John Q was released, the health insurance industry had begun to spin its counter message. Almost a week before the film's release, Blue Cross Blue Shield charged that the film reinforces ridiculous stereotypes about healthcare, glorifies violence as a means of problem solving, and needlessly frightens the public. The day before the movie opened, the American Association of Health Plans began running full-page ads in Washington and Hollywood newspapers declaring that, quote, the fictional character John Q has the wrong answer for America's health care crisis. Well, what is it that has the HMO industry in such a tizzy? Let's take a look and a listen to a clip from John Q.
Lieutenant Frank Grimes of the Chicago Police Department. Are you the man in charge?
That's right.
Well, who am I speaking to?
John Q.
I assume since all the doors are locked, this is a hostage situation. Is that correct?
Okay. Bless me, Father, for I've sinned. I know you do things your own way.
Blood pressure is dropping fast. He's going into cardiac arrest.
But I don't understand.
Mike's heart is useless. He's going to need a transplant or he's going to die.
What made Mike so sick?
Transplant surgery is very expensive.
We got insurance.
There are no provisions in your policy for a procedure of this magnitude.
All right, you want money. I'll get you the money.
We've recently switched carriers.
We only give assistance to patients without coverage.
I'm sorry, I can't help you.
Have you tried Medicaid?
No, you don't qualify.
My son is dying. I'm broke. If I don't qualify, who the hell does?
I've done everything I can do. I'm sorry.
Please.
They are releasing him. Now you need to do something.
I'll take care of him.
Hear me? Do something.
Your hospital's under new management now. Everybody does exactly what I say, nobody will get hurt.
More hurt.
I want my kid's name on the donor's list.
This is going to end up bad for you, John.
Police will do whatever is necessary to preserve the lives of these hostages.
Oh, they're telling me I got to take my son home and watch him die.
If you could speak to John Q right now, what would you say to him?
I'm there with you and you take care.
5:15, Frank. Something happens for me.
Are you praying for him, baby?
Yes, I'm praying, sweetheart.
He's a good kid.
You'd like him.
I am not gonna bury my son!
I got a shot at this guy and I'm gonna take it!
My son is gonna bury me!
Take the shot.
How's it gonna end, John?
I don't know.
John Q. Excerpts here on Democracy Now! We're joined in our Firehouse studio by Elizabeth Benjamin. She is the supervising attorney with the Health Law Unit of Legal Aid Society. If John Q had come to you, Elizabeth, instead of taking over the hospital, is there any way he could have gotten a heart transplant for his son?
Yeah, and I think the whole point of John Q for people who work around the health industry on the consumer side, unlike the HMOs that you were citing earlier when you introduced the piece, is that John Q had lots of options, and he had three basic options. The first option is anyone who has a COBRA triggering event like John Q did, which is he went from being a full-time employee down to a part-time employee, has the option to maintain his health insurance at full capacity. And he can do this even retrospectively. So, for example, the original understanding John Q had is suddenly his insurance didn't cover the transplant for his kid, but it used to. Well, then all he had to do is file an appeal with his insurance company, and he could have had his full insurance.
Well, let's talk about that, because there are a lot of people who didn't see the movie. But when he's told that his son is dying, he immediately goes back to work. And he wants to make sure that everything is covered. And they say, oh, sorry, John, we didn't tell you that when we cut your hours. He said, but that wasn't my fault.
Right.
He said, no, right. When we cut your hours, we also cut your health insurance, and it's much more limited now.
Right, but under federal law, you can that's a COBRA triggering event. And
what does that mean, COBRA?
It means
triggering.
COBRA, it's a provision of law. I'm not even going to go into all the complexities of it. But basically, it means that he had the right to re-up his full insurance with a little bit of money.
No, he did appeal it.
He did, and he won. But by then, the hospital had said, well, remember in the movie, Ann Hesch throws his win back at him. He had a little piece of paper proving that he had full insurance. And she throws it back at him across the table and said, no. You were supposed to file a grievance with your HMO, which is the second thing he could have done and prevailed, because we have filed grievances with HMOs and used other sort of tactics to encourage HMOs to actually provide transplants for children, and in fact have managed to acquire transplants for kids, even in policies that at first blush don't look like they cover them. So if he had grieved with his HMO, he could have prevailed. And many American consumers don't know that the first thing you need to do is file the grievance, file the appeal. At that point, Ann Hesch says, he says, well, let me do that. And Ann Hesch says, no, it's too late. You don't have time. The next thing that he could have done, because remember I said there were three ways that if he had come to like someone like us, legal aid or a managed care consumer assistance program.
Where are these managed care?
Well, there's one in New York State for upstate that sort of got mostly defunded in the wake of 9/11. And then there's one down in New York City that also the funding got frozen for in the wake of 9/11. Out in California, they have some programs, and also in the city of Chicago. There's a lot of federal movement to try to get these, what they're called ombuds programs or managed care consumer assistance programs, set up around the country, because people, health consumers, so desperately need help when facing insurance companies. It's gotten so complex. But the third thing that John Q could have had, and we heard it in that little clip, is he said, I don't get it. I'm totally broke and I don't qualify for Medicaid. Well, in fact, most children around the country can, even if they come from working class families, if they're sick enough, can spend down in order to qualify for Medicaid. So John Q could have paid a little bit of money and Medicaid would have paid for that transplant.
I don't understand. What could he have paid? How could he have? Basically, a family has to go totally broke.
Well, you have to go pretty broke. But actually, for example, in New York City, a family of three can earn like $1,000 a month. But for a child, they let him pay the difference, which from his earnings, which say it was $2,000 a month between him and his wife. So let's say they have a family of $20,000 or $30,000 a year, which they look like a pretty working class family. That would be about normal. They could have spent down they could have paid $6,000 and turned on their Medicaid. And no one properly informed them
about
that.
But that's the problem. I mean, you're laying out all these ways that everyone kept saying no to.
Right.
I mean, the head of the hospital, and played by Ann Hesch, yes, he successfully won his appeal to his HMO, and she just said, no, it doesn't matter. You have to do something else.
No, she said, you should have done something else. It's too late. And because the time pressure got so bad. And so you need to know how to, like, do the right thing. First of all, you need to know what your options are. You need to know how to approach them, and you need to approach them all at once.
But you're also talking about being in a time of crisis.
Correct.
You're facing a catastrophic event in your family. Your son is about to die.
And that's the last thing you want to be doing. And we have had, while we've been helping people through their healthcare problems, we've had people pass away. That happened to one of our clients this last week, in fact, and it's awful because our system is so backward. People end up not making it, and what they end up spending their last days is struggling with a bloody insurance plan.
We're also joined on the telephone by Archie Lamb, who is managing partner at the law offices in Birmingham, Alabama. We're hoping we'll be able to get him online, but until then, let me ask you, Elizabeth, when John Q takes over the hospital, ultimately his son is put on the list for organ donors. How does someone get on these lists? And is there something special for organ transplants?
There is a national organ list, and basically you go up in priority. When you the more severe your condition becomes, you advance up the list, and that's what happened to him. There was a big outrage a couple of years ago when some famous person who had smoked and done all sorts of, you know, bad things in his life and used drugs or something in the past ended up getting very high on the priority of the list because he got sicker and sicker and sicker. And people said, no, he doesn't deserve to be high up on the list. And that's not how we do it. We do it on whoever's sickest gets to the top of the list.
What about this whole lobbying campaign that the health industry waged right before the movie? I mean, saying just a week before the film was released, Blue Cross Blue Shield charged that the film, quote, reinforces ridiculous stereotypes about healthcare, glorifies violence as a means of problem solving, and needlessly frightens the public. And then you have the Association of Health Plans weighing in with full page ads that said that John Q has the wrong answer for America's healthcare crisis. Let me put that question to Archie Lamb, who represents the California Medical Association, Texas Medical Association, Florida Medical Association, Medical Association of Georgia, and a large class of individual physicians. He was designated lead counsel in the RICO lawsuit against HMOs pending in the federal court in the Southern District of Florida. What about the industry trying to derail this film?
Well, a couple of things, Amy. Number one, you can, as was outlined in the options that were available to John Q, we have a very complex appeal system that, by the way, is usually controlled by the insurance company, and discouragement at every turn is what most Americans face. I don't think anybody is advocating the vigilante-type conduct that is depicted in the movie, but the fact of the matter is that many Americans – the plans that are defendants in my lawsuit insure about 70 million of the 160 million Americans that have coverage. They face on a day-to-day basis delay and denial and discouragement. Unfortunately, most of the people who have problems don't understand the COBRA laws. In fact, I've been practicing law 17 years. I don't really understand them. So you've got folks who just don't understand what their options are and an appeal system that's controlled by the industry. The thing that was disingenuous about the industry's public spin on this matter is, if you read the ads in Variety and the other entertainment publications in the Washington Post, they tried to make John Q, the issue of John Q, an issue of the uninsured Americans, which is totally changing the subject. There are 40 million Americans, unbelievably, in this country that have no insurance. That's not what John Q was. John Q was a man who had worked for years, whose premiums had been deducted from his paycheck for years, who had been promised that when catastrophe hit, that insurance policy would be there. And when it happened, it wasn't. He was deceived. That's the message of John Q. He was deceived, and then when he tried to appeal, at every turn, he was turned away. That's the reality of what most Americans have to deal with in trying to get coverage, particularly for expensive coverage, under their policies.
Elizabeth, you wanted to add something there?
No, I absolutely agree with the speaker.
Mm-hmm. Archie Lamb, the doctor is not made out to look very good at the beginning of this film, in it for the money. What about the doctors that you represent, physicians, and the major issue that they have against the HMOs right now?
Well, two things about that. Number one, you know, there are abuses in all segments of our society, and none of us are perfect. But I will tell you, in the 3 years I've been getting to know physicians and their plight and their role in this thing, I've become a huge fan of the American doctor. In California in particular, there are 80% of the medical groups in California on the verge of financial insolvency. These doctors are out there putting their career, their family, their financial well-being on the line in a market that is dominated by just a handful of these monolithic multinational conglomerates. It's dominated by them, and so physicians are doing two things. Number one, they are also promised that we will pay you a certain reasonable amount, and we'll pay you timely by this industry. The industry does neither of those. So they break promises to the doctors who are business people who deserve to be paid that which they're promised. And by attaching themselves, leeching the managed care companies, leeching themselves to the revenue stream of physicians and hospitals, they insert themselves directly between the physician and the patient because they control the care that's meted out. That's one of the other subtext issues in John Q. The fact that the insurance company won't pay for the care means that the hospital and the doctor can't afford to give it to the child. And thus, by denying revenue, you deny care. So,
Elizabeth Benjamin of Legal Aid, you disagree with Archie Lamb.
Well, I mean, Archie Lamb is right, except that the bottom line is that the hospitals and the doctors, you know, spend millions of dollars lobbying state, federal, and local governments in order to make sure that they maintain their market share. And they haven't exactly band together with the 40 million uninsured Americans and said, okay, let's forget it. Let's just go for national health insurance, which is the only thing, the only fair way to get everybody full insurance. And that, you know, everyone would have the same rules about who gets to get the transplant and who doesn't. And I think that's a simpler model than just trying to sort of fight it out for doctors to maintain their market share. And that's the only thing I worry about when I hear from the doctor's side of the story. I think we lose the consumer really quickly.
The only thing, if I can just jump in here and disagree, the concept of the doctors controlling the market share is an interesting one and, in fact, a fallacy, because the simple fact of the matter is the insurance industry, through a variety of legislative immunities, and I don't want to, you know, McCarran-Ferguson, ERISA, the HMO Act itself, is immune from scrutiny. In other words, they are not held accountable. For an example, a woman go in to get a mammography. It's denied by the insurance company. She later develops breast cancer and dies. If that woman's family wants to challenge the insurance company, they can take it all the way through this administrative process that was discussed earlier. All they get back in the end is the cost of the mammography. There is no independent right to sue the HMO.
Elizabeth Benjamin.
I mean, I think it's outrageous that there's no independent right to sue HMOs, which are in fact practicing medicine, and it's totally outrageous. Couldn't agree with Mr. Lamb more. I'm just saying that I don't feel that sorry for the hospitals and doctors and other providers who refuse to support national health insurance, which is the only thing that's going to make it be fair for everyone in this system.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. We'll certainly continue to discuss this issue outside of the context of Hollywood. Elizabeth Benjamin, supervising attorney with the Health Law Unit at the Legal Aid Society, and Archie Lamb, managing partner at Archie Lamb LLC in Birmingham, Alabama, representing a number of medical associations and a large class of individual physicians. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we are going to look at an Oscar-nominated film that is a documentary. We'll see what happens with it on Sunday night. It is called Promises and is about Israel and Palestine through the eyes of children. Stay with us.
Thank you.
Denny Bonet and Tony Salvatore live in our Firehouse studio. You are listening to Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman. Israelis and Palestinians resumed truce talks today despite two recent Palestinian suicide attacks, including one that killed three Israelis on Thursday. The attacks initially prompted Israel to walk out in the talks and sparked a sharp rebuke from President Bush. Meanwhile, even before the bombings that rocked the truce talks, Israeli forces entered a number of West Bank villages meant to be under full Palestinian control. Early Thursday morning, armored tanks moved into the towns while a throng of troops arrested at least 25 Palestinians. Later, Israeli bulldozers destroyed all roads leading to the West Bank city of Nablus, effectively sealing it off from the rest of the Palestinian territories. As well as the newspapers continue to list the daily death count and to track the diplomatic back and forth, it's sometimes easy to forget that lives, real lives, are being lived on both sides of the conflict. Among these lives are millions of children, kids who are not only innocent victims, but also future protagonists in this decades-old drama, their voices rarely heard. Today, we're going to hear some of their voices. A new Oscar-nominated documentary called Promises brings the stories of seven Israeli and Palestinian children to the big screen for perhaps the first time. Though they live only 20 minutes apart, the seven children exist in completely separate lives, in separate worlds. We're going to listen to a few clips of some of these children, beginning with Moisha. When an Arab sees me, he thinks I am one of those who took his land. They think it's their land, and we think it's ours. We know it's ours. This is Mahmoud. This is my land. I was born and raised here. You have no right to take it.
But I understand them because
this is
Shlomo. They were thrown out of here 50 years ago, and they feel very, very small, very, like, hurt. Because they were thrown out that way.
This is Yarko. I think this is our home. When extremists say the other side shouldn't live here, that's wrong. There was a war and we conquered it. I don't know what to do now. Just some of the children who are featured in this documentary, Promises. Bezi Goldberg, co-director and co-producer of the film Promises, was born in Boston, grew up in Israel outside Jerusalem, covered the first intifada as a television journalist with Reuters TV, the BBC, NBC, CNN. In 95, he left his TV job to begin making Promises, his first feature-length film. The movie was shot from 1997 to 2000. And was nominated for an Oscar in this year's Best Documentary category. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Bezi Goldberg.
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about the kids now? First, how old are they? And one of the places that you really focus are the children in the Dehesha refugee camp, which is the site of extreme repression right now, with the Israeli military having retaken the camp.
The kids today are between the ages of 15 and 17. The kids in Dehesha are among the most misfortunate of all of them. They're kids who've been living the last 18 months under virtual military siege and under intense military attack in the last 3 weeks or so. Actually, Sanabel, the girl who participates in the film, is with us right now in Los Angeles. Some of the kids from the film, Sanabel, as well as the twins, Yarko and Danielle, have come to join us here during the Academy Award season.
At the end of the movie, you go to the children 2 years later. The Palestinian children still want to talk, deeply affected by what happened to them when they met with the Israeli children that you also featured. But the Israeli children, the twins who seemed the most concerned, had just entered their own lives and said even though the Palestinian kids had called them and tried to keep in touch, they no longer had these concerns. and you see the Palestinian children really suffering at the end.
Yeah, I think you know, the Israeli kids exemplified something very, very painful and present in Israeli society, which is that most Israelis really, really do want peace, desperately, and they don't deal with it on a day-to-day basis. It's a luxury that they have. They really desperately want to live their own lives. For the twins, it means playing volleyball and, you know, being kids. Kids should really, and I believe on both sides, kids should not be forced to be the ones to solve the situation. And the other thing that they show us is that the borders and the boundaries and the checkpoints and the boundaries in minds and hearts on both sides of the divide are very deep. It's very, very difficult for these kids to meet. The truth is that today, even if they wanted to meet, even if they were willing to make the effort, it's actually impossible for these children to meet. It is literally illegal for the Israeli kids to travel to Dehesha, and it would be illegal for the kids from Dehesha to travel to West Jerusalem.
Faraj was a particularly poignant young man in your film, a Palestinian refugee living at Dehesha. At five, he saw a friend killed by an Israeli soldier after marching in an anti-Israel rally. He and his grandmother snuck across the checkpoint into Israel with you to visit the village that she fled in 1948. And they sat on stones that were once their family home. And Faraj vows to return one day to rebuild and holds up the key that his grandmother gave him to his original house. Where is he now?
Faraj is, Faraj would really love to leave, and he would love to come to the United States and live here. He said a lot of times that he doesn't want to live in the Palestinian territories. He feels like his life is over there. He doesn't, he stands a serious chance of being killed, and he'd like to get out of there and come over here or to Europe as fast as possible.
You said Sanibel is with you now in Los Angeles. In the film, she talks about and visits her father, who is a journalist who's been held in Israeli prison for 2 years without trial. What is his situation now?
Hassan's situation is that he's been released, and Sanibel was actually on 60 Minutes the other couple nights ago, and she spoke very, very vehemently and strongly about the situation, and she said, you know, my father was released from prison, and I was so happy, but I realized after a short period that he may be released from prison, but that we're all in prison. Now, she really experiences her life as a prisoner in this kind of very small strip of land, but he is out of jail.
If you win on Sunday night the Oscar for your documentary, what are you going to say?
We don't know. We're actually working on it. We're trying to work on it with the kids. We always have negotiated everything with the children. You know, we wanted to make a film that did a couple of things. We wanted to give voice to these kids and not be condescending or patronizing to them. So we always kind of gave them the stage and let them help us figure out what it is that needs to be said. So we're going to be working on that together with them.
Well, Beezy Goldberg, thank you very much for joining us and waking up early today to speak with us. Beezy Goldberg, co-director and co-producer of the film Promises, which has been nominated for an Oscar. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to get contact information, you can go to our website at www.democracynow.org. That's democracynow.org. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, and Jeremy Scahill. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. We're being serenaded in our Firehouse studio by musicians Denny Bonet and Tony Salvatore. We are broadcasting from downtown community television, just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!
Oh, when I need you, now what I really need is not to need you so very much. And when you need me, that's what you barely need. You need to need me, not very much. I want to be